Hi there, it's Fred. Before we start, if you have been digging Narcosis but want to hear the entire show as a single binge listen without ads, check out our new Omnibus Uncut Edition episode drop, which has happened today alongside this episode. You can only access it as a Realm subscriber, so you can become one. If you're on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to Realm Plus or use Realm Unlimited with any other service. Visit realm.fm/unlimited to get started. Did you leave Sinclair Island soaked with salt water and wondering what other mysteries lurk beneath the sea? Dive into the story of how Narcosis came to be when we speak with series lead writer Chris Bernier just after this.
Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits. I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics Viral Tubing Mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CauseMetics, .com/thrive for 20% off your first order.
Hi, this is Fred Greenhall, creator of Narcosis and host of Undertow, Realm's podcast of original audio horror. Today I'm speaking with Chris Bernier, lead writer on Narcosis. You heard Chris back at the top of the season where the two of us were chatting, gave you a taste of what the series was all about. In today's episode, we go deeper about what draws us to aquatic horror and horror in general, why the hell is Maine so scary, why do we love Wicker Man, what are some of our favorite movies. This episode does include tons of spoilers. We were expecting you've already heard Narcosis. If you have not listened to Narcosis, stop now, go back, listen to the season, and then come back because we're going a little bit deeper. Still here? Excellent. Here we go. Chris Bernier talking Narcosis. Chris, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm really good. Thank you.
So listeners, I sure hope you have listened to all of Narcosis before you got this far. Here's our chance to sort of dive deeper, as it were. So let's start here, Chris, with how did you get involved in this project and kind of come on board?
Yeah, no, it was really kind of a wonderful opportunity. I think, you know, that arrived sort of organically. I was a fan of Undertow, and you and I had developed sort of a dialogue. We were starting to getting to know each other. One of the things that we talked about early on, I remember, is marveling at the fact that Maine has something around like 4,000 islands off its coast. And you and I have both spent time on some of the populated islands off the coast and always felt like that was a pretty unique and interesting environment. And then I think also, you know, in the past few years, Maine, like a lot of other places, has gone through pretty rapid change with out-of-staters moving in. I guess technically, even though my family is all from Northern Maine, on my father's side, I'm technically an out-of-towner too. I moved in just a few years ago. But there has been a real influx. And with that influx, you know, the people come and they sort of bring their lifestyle, they bring their wants and needs with them. And a lot of that has been changing the face of Maine culture in a pretty quick, rapid fire way. And some of the islands that are more seasonal, that are more popular resort destinations, we've seen pretty dramatic change. And then also a sort of fascinating local resistance to the change. And I think that was the inception of us talking about, hey, like, let's do something that lives in the zone of aquatic horror based in around the sea. And gee, wouldn't doing something around an island in Maine be a cool thing? And which I think it was. And then you were the one that I think was like, why don't we build it around a dive expedition?
Yeah, because I think, so somehow this idea of literally going underneath the surface is kind of was our entrance to that of like, yes, we can have a coastal island with all the sort of these dynamics, which are very rich to begin with. And then let's just like put humans underwater, because even on a good day, going underwater is sort of like one mechanical failure away from disaster and horror.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Hadn't really been done, you know, I think. Centering it around the island of St. Clair, so a seasonal resort island that has some very sort of blatant similarities to, like, let's say, Amity Island from Jaws, and the kind of consistent politics of these sort of communities, because you do need to ensure that business is good in the high season. Marrying that with a underwater adventure rescue story that then pulls in these sort of supernatural qualities, which we realize through, you know, through listening to the series, there's a direct kind of causality. There's a connection between this sort of supernatural quality existing beneath the surface and the power struggle and structure within the island.
Yeah. And I don't know how philosophical to get, but I think we all know the surface versus the bulk of the iceberg, you know, that so much more is beneath the surface. And sort of on a mythological level, the ocean is very much associated with like the subconscious or the dream environment. And, you know, even sort of the most rational people, you know that there is something else going on. And so I think without doing it in any sort of like really writerly way of like beating it over your head, like that's just sort of part of the dynamic of the texture of like that is and that is sort of kind of very, very literal practical sense. The nature of living on an island is like you are connected with the stuff happening underneath the ocean, whether or not you choose to believe in it or agree with it, but you just sort of are. And I think, you know, people who are locals to islands, it's like not even something they have to, it'd be hard to explain. It's just how it works here. Like you know, like your day revolves around the ferry schedule, and certain things you do at certain times of year because you can't do it other times of year, and this just certain things are not done. And so it ends up being sort of this environment that could have what feels like to an outsider like a very kind of unique, like, you know, Wicker Man like kind of like code of do's and don'ts, but that's just like what it is actually like, the lived reality of being close to a natural environment where to this day, if the ferry service is down for some reason because of choppy waters, if you're on an island, you're on an island, and a lot of days you might have internet, but if the internet goes out and no one's coming for you for a while, you're suddenly in a very different type of situation. And so that's all sort of there literally, but also sort of metaphorically in our story.
Yeah. I mean, there are areas, and I think that was something that we were really interested in and continue to be interested in, is exploring that sort of intersection of kind of like old world folkloric wisdom and modern society, modern existence, and kind of the clash of those two elements. You know, I mean, people have often said, and I think there's a lot of truth to the idea that, you know, all great horror is a social metaphor. I think that's maybe an overstatement in some regards, I should put it this way. I don't think you want to be too overt or blatant with your sort of social sentiment, but I think what we were excited by was creating these dynamics, creating a complex mythology, complex world, and then just sort of telling a simple story at the heart of that.
So I'd love to hear more from your perspective as you know, most of your career is focused on screenwriting. What, as far as, you know, making a horror podcast, what felt similar? What felt different? What was unexpected along the way?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll give you some credit for sort of framing this for me coming in, because I had never written a podcast series before. Hadn't even really given it much thought. And you were the one that sort of framed it up that it sort of lives between a season of TV and a feature film. And that's kind of right, I would say. Like, it's sort of a supersize extended feature film in terms of the level of kind of character depth and just narrative load that you're delivering in a season of a podcast. And then, you know, the very obvious thing is that everything that you're writing has to be brought to life in audio terms. And so you're thinking about opportunities to create really interesting audio landscapes. And I think where the horror genre has always excelled, and obviously we're in a really kind of strong moment for the genre, people are really into horror these days, is that horror tends to be very immediately propulsive and engaging. It's sort of deeply psychological, deeply spiritual. Like, really, if you want to sort of plot horror as a genre on the kind of like constellation of human existence, it really is about a meditation unto death, right? That's what horror stories are. As visceral or as slow burn as they are, it's all a meditation unto death, and kind of very cathartic in that sense. I think to do that in audio terms, to find these sort of quiet, kind of almost spooky, gothic world-building opportunities. Can you get a more sort of creepy setting than an island off the coast of Maine? You know, you can kind of hear the buoys ringing, and you know, the winds blowing off the shore. Like, there's just a quality to it that my hope was in writing it, really, was that you felt like you were descending with Veronica and her team.
I think I want to talk specifically about The Descent, because that was a film you had surfaced as a reference point early-ish on. And one of the things that I think really resonated with both of us as we approached Narcosis was like the general gist of where we were going has so much tension in it. Let's ratchet that up as far as possible before we add the fact that there might be something beyond human physics down there too. What was appealing to that, and how do you think we did?
Yeah, so The Descent is, you know, an incredible horror movie. Came out in 2005. Probably the scariest movie I've seen since I saw that in the theaters in 2005. And it's about a group of women who are old friends, some of whom are estranged from each other for personal reasons. And they're going on a spelunking trip, a cave exploring trip together, which seems like a strange thing. But other than the sort of incredibly personal way into and through that movie that you take from the perspective of the main character, it's still a very effective ensemble. And to your point, it is structured in a way where you're dealing with sort of like the human struggle. It becomes kind of a human survival tale in the first half, and is an incredibly effective, gripping human survival tale. And then around the midpoint, something else shows up. And when that something else shows up, I remember the first time I saw it, all the oxygen got sucked out of the theater. And I was just, you know, really kind of white knuckled from there in. And to maintain an incredibly personal through line through that movement from something that is a survival, human survival struggle story into something that becomes supernatural really carries you through some weird stuff and some weird ideas. But you're in it because you're in it with the main character. You want to see how her story plays through. So that one was a big reference for us.
Yeah, yeah, and I'd say, obviously, those who've listened to Narcosis were basically rooted with Veronica. We cheat a couple times, but it's as you were saying earlier, it's all sort of locked through one point of view, which was like a deliberate choice. I remember there's earlier versions of the script where in the portion in the caves, it did a little bit more cutting back and forth between the surface and underwater, and it ultimately felt really interesting and sort of very isolating to be like, let's just stay in the water as long as we can make this work, because that only helps us get this sense of actually
that's right.
what it feels like to have, you know, several hundred million gallons of water right. between you and safety.
Yeah. I mean, it's just inherently terrifying because most of us aren't professional divers, and I guess probably most of us aren't even divers at all. And so the idea of being trapped underwater is something that is inherently terrifying. And so when you layer things on top of that, I think that's a little bit of the challenge, is like you can almost have too much sort of terror cognitive load to sort of cancel it all out. But I think that's where we tried to organize things in a way that felt rewarding and where people were sort of in the experience of the divers and sort of experiencing that journey and the thrills with them. There's two other movies that I for me, I keep coming back to when I think about Narcosis and where influences to. One you mentioned before, which is Wicker Man. And the other is a smaller movie called Messiah of Evil. And both of those movies came out in 1973. Wicker Man is pretty well known. It's sort of the quintessential folk horror movie, certainly in the sort of British horror tradition. It's the quintessential, if not British horror film, certainly the quintessential British folk horror film. And Messiah of Evil, I would say, is like a perfect corollary to it. And really, it's kind of like, even though it's very underseen, it's kind of like the California folk horror version of a 1973 person in a strange land sort of a movie. And I think the reason why Narcosis for me really resonates as a folk horror thing is that because it is living at this intersection of old world traditions, many of which continue today, even if it is in a quiet, you know, sort of quiet practices that are held and reserved to a few who are in the know, meets someone who is kind of clashing up against that. And that also, you know, I think as that starts to render and play out in the course of the narrative in Veronica's story, folk horror tends to start to sort of pull, you know, the membrane of reality to where things take on a more dreamlike kind of like truly supernatural quality. So it's not like, it doesn't become like, oh, these supernatural things that Veronica's facing are ideas, but yeah. that you're sort of like engaged with it in a way that through her. And so then I think that's where folk horror is sort of an interesting tradition, is that it the best versions of folk horror sort of do that, yeah. where you sort of become like ingrained in the culture. And you know, probably like a really strong recent example of this would be like Ari Aster's Midsommar. Mm-hmm. You know, like Midsommar, you're in it.
Yeah.
And you get down into the, you know, as you get down into the depths with Midsommar, it becomes a very strange trip, but you're brought there incrementally.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and it sort of avoids, like, there's such a trope in horror movies or, you know, anything with magic of like the people being in the grounded world having to have the moment of like, I don't believe in the thing and now I believe in the thing, or I have to get over believing in the thing. And the sort of the folk horror sort of, to me, spins this idea around that, like, you know, in simpler times and other times or in remote places or places where like the modern world doesn't have such a hold, this idea that there's, you know, more than the modern world's scientific method can explain to us is just sort of more the culturally held as a thing. And so the idea that there's, you know, sea creatures out there or ghosts or thin places or, you know, gods to appease is all just sort of more believable in the folk. Because you're sort of slowly brought into a culture that fully is bought into this stuff, as opposed to having to go from like skeptic in act one to, you know, bought into being chased by a demon in act three kind of.
Yep. Stuff. That's exactly right. I mean, it's, you know, from the main character's perspective, it's wild and irrational, but it's happening.
Yeah.
And there's something about that sort of a journey that is really exciting to me as a storyteller and as a fan. Yeah. Like, I like being brought on those sorts of journeys.
And I think in some ways it's more honest, because if we actually have experiences, you know, where we encounter things that felt like you know, whatever, I've never seen a UFO, but if I can imagine that people, it feels very real to them. People don't sit there saying, I'm seeing something and I can't believe it. Like, if you've ever had an experience that felt sort of otherworldly, it has a way of like, it just sort of feels like an experience. It's not like, oh, I've left the real world and now I'm in this magical world. It sort of just feels like a thing happened. And like you learn later, like, wait, I don't think I can really explain that thing that happened, or the thing that happened sort of defied what my programming has told me is possible. But you don't in the moment think, oh, look, this must be a ghost, right?
That's right.
It's not how you actually.
That's right. And so to play that out in a way that is very close to the main character and keeping it within her experience, hopefully imbibes it or gives it a quality of resonance that I think gets deprived if you're too blatant or literal with some of these ideas, or too spoon-fed, or too overly logic-based, or worried about everything being very cleanly defined. Because my problem is with stories that do that is I'm like, the world isn't that way. Like my existence is not all clearly defined.
If only our world made sense.
So it's like, why would I want a story that is very sort of clearly, cleanly delineated? I don't think that's what we want anymore. I think that there was a prevailing wisdom that that's what people wanted. And maybe in certain genres, that's what they wanted. But I think the horror genre really is about this meditation on life and death and what's beyond.
And we've been talking with Chris Bernier, lead writer on Narcosis. We'll be keeping our conversation about folk horror and the occult going just after this. Do you ever wonder who's looking over your shoulder when you're exploring the web? Do you want to keep tracking cookies, curious websites, and your internet service provider from sniffing out too much about your browsing activity? What about gaining the ability to virtually travel to different parts of the world and reshape your internet experience? Well, enter NordVPN. NordVPN protects your internet privacy and lets you go borderless. You can experience sporting events and entertainment that aren't available in your region. When you're on the go, NordVPN protects your data while accessing public Wi-Fi, and in tandem with the Nord Threat Protection Service, protects you from malicious downloads, viruses, and phishing sites. Best of all, this protection is laser fast, so avoid buffering and lagging while streaming or gaming, and stop your ISP from bandwidth throttling. If you've never used a VPN before, you may be surprised how much your internet experience is shaped by what country of origin you're believed to be from. I've actually had quite a bit of fun using NordVPN as a learning tool with my kids. We change around our virtual location, go to different countries, revisit familiar websites from a new country of origin, and see how things are different. For the cost of a cup of coffee a month, your NordVPN account can be used on up to 6 devices. So why wait? Get the best discount off your NordVPN plan by going to nordvpn.com/undertow. Our link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. And there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nordvpn.com/undertow.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm. You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
I mean, more broadly, as a writer or even just a person who really is passionate about stories, like, what do you gravitate to or away from?
I like things that combine qualities of different genres. Like, take Pet Sematary, for example, right? Like, what is Pet Sematary? Is that American folk horror? Is that a zombie story? Is that an animals attacks movie? Is it a ghost story? It's kind of all those things, but it's uniquely its own thing. And it comes from a real singular vision. And then certainly things that, you know, I have a tendency to gravitate also towards things that feel more personal. I think classic examples of that in the horror genre would be movies like Rosemary's Baby or The Shining, where you're sort of really in the psychology of one or, you know, perhaps two of the characters, and you're sort of on this slippery slope with them. But I mean, I still feel like horror movies need to be fun, mm-hmm. You know? Like, I tend to sort of stay away from horror comedy. I don't really get into horror comedy. I think there have been a couple directors who've done that real well, but I wouldn't even kind of classify them as horror comedy. Like, the Evil Dead movies are fun and have comedic moments, but I wouldn't call them horror comedy. But, you know, for me, the energy that I try to go for is, something like John Carpenter's The Thing or even Jaws, where there's real horror at play and a scary environment, but also like a light to it too, like a lightness and a brightness to it, and maybe like a glimmer of hope.
Well, the only thing I say that, I feel like we gotta give credit to some of our characters. So Billy Moyes is a Chris Bernier original character. I think he's become a fan favorite. You know, adds a lot of that because maybe he's just someone who, you know, doesn't take life very seriously, but at the same time is a very serious person, the kind of person you trust with your life. He's not goofing around, but at the same time, he does have that characteristic to him. So I don't know. Yeah, I guess with that sort of point of view in mind, either Billy specifically or generally, how does that inform?
Yeah, I mean, I think you gotta, it's a load balancing exercise for me. And I think you wanna make sure when you're, you know, as a writer, I always try to make sure that like there's certain, usually characters, supporting characters who can kind of help bring a little bit of a pressure release because you'll need it. And typically the journey for your main character, you know, and this is certainly true in Narcosis with an exclamation point, the journey for Veronica is very serious, very personal and very serious all throughout, very harrowing. But yeah, I think Billy Moyes comes in to sort of bring a little bit of levity. I think, you know, even the support dive team brings certainly some levity to it and just brings that energy of fun and unexpected and sort of wildness that I think just helps with the tonal movement of the piece.
Are there a particular favorite scene or two that come to mind?
I mean, I really think that the stuff with Veronica in the cave, as she kind of gets deeper into the inner sanctum, is where I sort of feel like that's where the show has really found its like groove. Like, if I had to be like, what is this show? I would probably pluck out that section, even as it gets sort of strange and otherworldly. I think that's some of my favorite stuff. I also just, you know, think it's pretty extraordinary, like the way that the ending goes down, you know, and that, like, you know, you've got, you know, the ostensibly the antagonist that's just like firing a machine gun into a tidal wave. Yes. You know what I mean? So it's like it's sort of interesting to see how it goes. I guess what you would say a bit gonzo, yeah, at the end there. But I also find that to be like a lot of the sort of the fun spirit of it.
There's lots of great stuff, but the stuff with Alice, I think, is interesting. I mean, there's such richness there. Alice is, you know, not your average young girl in a horror movie, but also like it's sort of like a mirror of what Veronica might have been younger, but she's also like, you know, there's
Alice is listening to her father and grandfather. Yeah. And that to me is a moment of pure horror.
Yeah.
Where you're like, oh, these guys have, she sort of has known they're behind it, but now it's just like she's fully reconciling it in that moment, and that they need to sort of maintain her and groom her to carry their sort of dark family tradition forward. Like that to me is just stuff. Yeah, you know, that's the stuff.
And that was another thing I think we did very intentionally, was to have like, yes, there is a monster, but the monster, the creature is not necessarily the biggest monster in the story. Is there anything else about Maine that we haven't talked about why is this a state that is such a rich launch pad for horror storytelling?
I think Maine is this convergent state that still feels very much like a frontier landscape. I think due to the cold winters, which are significant and very cold, that scares a lot of people off. And I think that's just led to a culture and a way of life here that is hard. I think geographically, the fact that so much of Maine is surrounded by water on one side and the other side is really buttressed by impenetrable forest. And then we're a border state. So we share a long border with Canada, obviously. And I think there's a lot of history. There's a lot of undercurrent and undertow to the history here, where, you know, there's been sort of early colonial struggle and certainly some dark, sad chapters in this history of Maine. The people here are strong and they're vigilant and they sort of wear their day-to-day with pride. And I think there's a certain integrity to Maine that is based in the land and the sea that is pretty quintessential.
Yeah, Stephen King made up a lot of things, but there's something about the character of Maine where he's just sort of capturing the reality and not inventing the reality.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably Stephen King would even admit that, like, Maine and the backdrop of Maine is obviously integral to who he is. He's always been a Mainer. But I think just bringing that stuff to light, he would probably admit is like a lot of his recipe, you know, is just what the true nature of Maine is, and then giving that kind of like a supernatural spin or quality, because the living can be hard here, you know.
It is, and we're coming off the winter solstice period where definitely people were checking in their stores and hoping they had enough firewood and something in the root cellar and dry meat to get through, because it might, you know, it's a little weird in these climate change infused days, but you know, the living's maybe, I don't know, it's still never easy.
I think I would be interested to hear from you, Fred, and maybe this is something you'll touch on in other portions of the podcast, other sort of after the episodes, but Where does this one, like, how does this one nest within the overall lexicon of Maine things? And, you know, not even in terms of like the shared universe quality per se, but just in terms of like, how do you feel like this entry is different or similar to the other seasons that you've done?
There's definitely something that's much more grounded, you know. In Blood Forest, there were literal werewolves that sort of was literal magic to use them. And in Simpson Falls, there, you know, was a mechanism that maybe, you know, we have other dimensions and shit, which like maybe on quantum physics theory, there's like sort of a way that all exists, but it was like, it was executed in such a way that was not, that was sort of you close cousins to magic. So, you know, yes, we have a creature, and I guess we haven't talked about that too much. So maybe it is worth talking about our creature design a little bit. Cause we did have some, you know, the funnest conversations you get to have are like, what is this entity and how does the psychosphere work? And though there's something about it that does feel supernatural, we kind of like grounded it in like something that, like the idea that there could be something underneath the sea that is new to humanity is not really science fiction. I mean, there's still more that humans are discovering about the sea all the time. And the idea that like, you know, just with like hallucinogens, there's like stuff that people experience once they get a little bit of frog, lick a frog, you know, or like ayahuasca or whatever. So like the idea that there, you could be this sort of like symbiotic relationship with a creature that allowed you to access this sort of like alternate world. There's also like maybe even entire episodes that did not make the cut or pages and pages of sort of backstory or parts of the island and all this stuff that, even if it's not necessarily physically on the page or in the actual performances, like was there for us in the creation process. So like, we know that there is a multi-hundred-year-old story of what happened on this island, which when you do get into moments where you're picking out certain things, like just gives it that sense of heft that this is like actually a real world we're inhabiting and not just like, you know, a playground.
Yeah. I mean, I think that you're totally like hitting it on the head for me too, in a way that I hadn't totally thought about, but it is almost like Sinclair feels like this place that as the one of the storytellers behind it, I want to kind of return to, you know, like, because it feels lived in.
Yeah.
Like I'm pretty proud of like that aspect of it, as much as we were sort of connecting the dots and drafting off of existing main locales. I think it feels like this place that like I can feel it. I can see the map of it in my mind.
Yes. No, we, I don't know that we actually physically drew a map, but I do remember us having like conversations about what is the actual geography here? Could they actually have gotten from point A to point B in this amount of time? And just like that, there is a very much a psychic map of the island. Chris, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me along on this journey.
Awesome. And we hope to be working on something else cool, but we'll you'll stay apprised right here, dear listeners. Thank you for listening to Undertow, and we will give you some more scares next time.
And that was Chris Bernier, who we hope to have back to pen no more stories here on Undertow. But if you dig his work, you can find more of his stuff online. Most easily his novella, Dead Man's Suit, which is available to download for free on Amazon right now. Look for Dead Man's Suit. And for now, this is Fred signing off on Undertow. We will have more juicy, dark things for you to come, so keep an eye here on your podcast feed for more tales of the weird and the wicked. Till then, catch you later. Undertow is a production of Realm, hosted by me, Fred Greenhalgh, produced by Nicole Kreuter, associate produced by Devin Shepard, executive produced by Fred Greenhalgh and Molly Barton. Original theme by Hubert Campbell. Find more shows like Undertow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever podcasts are served.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.